Greetings and welcome to today's program and meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Mark Zitter, a member of the club's member-led forum and chair of today's program. The last several decades have seen a tremendous amount of excitement and an equal degree of disappointment over the use of information technology to make healthcare work better. Today's speaker will help us understand both the problems and the promise of the movement to digitize medicine. Dr. Robert Wachter is professor and associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, where he holds the Lynn and Mark Benioff Endowed Chair in Hospital Medicine and directs the 55-physician division of Hospital Medicine. I first met Bob about 20 years ago when I asked him to speak about the then-new field of hospital medicine at a national meeting. Bob coined the term hospitalist in 1996 and is generally considered the father of the hospitalist field, which is the fastest-growing specialty in the history of modern medicine. He's past president of the Society of Hospitalist Medicine and the immediate past chair of the American Board of Internal Medicine. A graduate of the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and UCSF's residency program in internal medicine, Bob has written 6 books and more than 250 articles. 2 of those books have focused on the important issue of medical safety. His work in that field earned him the 2004 John M. Eisenberg Award, the nation's top honor in patient safety. For the past 8 years, Modern Healthcare magazine has named him one of the 50 most influential physician executives in the U.S., and the 2015 list just came out last week, and he's on it again, this time ranked as number 1. So, be prepared to have your thinking influenced by America's most influential physician executive tonight. Recently, Bob has turned his attention and his talent to the massive effort to incorporate computers into all facets of medical practice. That's the focus of his latest book, published just earlier this month by McGraw-Hill. It's titled, The Digital Doctor: Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. He will be signing copies of this book immediately following this program. The Commonwealth Club is delighted to have him with us to discuss this important topic. Please help me welcome Dr. Bob Wachter.
Thank you for that delightful and generous introduction. It is true that it just came out that I was listed as the number one most influential physician. I'm quite convinced it was a typo, that I'm number 10, and they dropped the 0, but I'm going to run with it because I got a book to sell. I'm looking forward to talking to you. I'm going to talk about computerization in medicine, and I think this is a topic that's highly relevant, whether you're a physician or a nurse or someone who has health needs or may have health needs, namely everybody. Let me start out with a conflict of interest, and it's traditional to do that. Here is my conflict of interest. I'm hoping to stimulate you to want to read the book, and if I'm successful, I will do that. This is an immensely interesting topic. I want to make clear how difficult it is to sell a book like this. First of all, when you launch on Amazon, you're at about number 8 millionth, which is unbelievably dispiriting. And then you claw your way up, and I found that I was moving up pretty rapidly over the last few weeks, and then about a week ago, I made the mistake of doing a search on Amazon, and when you put in Digital Doctor on Amazon under books, my book comes up first, but second is Dr. Romance Medical Erotica, the billionaire doctor's erotic and romantic hospital bachelor short story, and I can't imagine that I could successfully compete with that book, and I have no plans on taking my shirt off to try to do it. It's not going to work. Let me tell you why this is such an interesting issue and how I got interested in this issue. As Mark mentioned, I've been interested in medical mistakes for the last 15 or 20 years, and unfortunately we have a lot of them. And for someone interested in medical mistakes, I can't tell you the number of times where at UCSF we had an error. We committed an error, we gave a patient the wrong medication or some other problem, and we sat around the table and we said, if we just had computers, it would have fixed this. It would have signaled to us that these two drugs interact with each other in a bad way, or would have guided us to evidence-based treatment or something wonderful and magical The doctor's handwriting was indecipherable and somebody blew it in reading the handwriting. It was natural to believe that computers would fix our problems in healthcare. I think that was part of the problem. The second problem was my iPhone, because I think we've all come to believe that you pull out your iPhone and you download an app, and the next thing you know, you're off finding the nearest Starbucks and making a restaurant reservation or figuring out the route to get here and where to park. It was so magical and so easy that I think we came to believe that wiring the healthcare system would be similarly easy and straightforward. And maybe if Apple had done it, it would have been. But they didn't, and it hasn't. And so over the last 3 or 4 years, as the healthcare system has gotten wired, and I'll tell you why that only happened over the last 3 or 4 years, I think many of my colleagues and I were clearly cognizant of the positive aspects of computerization, but also were seeing unforeseen consequences, are seeing changes in our work and our workflow and the way we thought and the way we interacted with patients. And although it was preventing certain kinds of errors, it was creating new ones. And I think the combination of all those things led me first to begin pitching stories to my wife, whose name is Katie Hafner, and she writes for the New York Times. And I kept on saying to my wife, you should write about this. And so she started writing stories about, are we going to need smart doctors in the age of IBM Watson? After you watch Watson beat the Jeopardy champions, I think it was legitimate to wonder whether we need doctors anymore. And she did other stories on different aspects of this, the difference between young people in medicine and older people in terms of whether you're digitally native. And then about a year and a half ago at UCSF, I'll tell you the story in a few minutes, but we committed a remarkable error, and an error that could not have happened in the paper world. It was an error really caused by computerization. And I came home and I said, I think I need to write about this. And my wife was smart enough to say, you need to do this journalistically, which means the only way you're going to do this successfully is go around and talk to everybody. So I spent about a year running around the country talking to leaders of healthcare information technology companies, experts in artificial intelligence at places like Stanford and MIT, federal policymakers, frontline doctors, nurses, patients. I spent a day at Boeing headquarters to see how they think about computer design. And it was remarkably interesting. And at the end of it, I think I understood the whole elephant. I think I understood this really complex story in ways that I certainly didn't when I started. And that's really what I wrote about and what I'd like to try to share with you tonight. I'll talk for about 30 or 35 minutes. I'd like to leave at least 15 minutes for discussion, and I will commit myself to doing that. Let us start at the beginning. And the beginning of the modern era of computerization of healthcare comes with this speech, the State of the Union Address, by President Bush in 2004. And contextualizing it, the Iraq War was a year old. It was going fairly poorly. You remember the mission accomplished speech, and then things went kind of off the rails. And the president was looking for a domestic issue to pivot to, because he was coming up for a reelection campaign, that would have wide bipartisan support. And as Hillary Clinton learned about 20 years ago and Barack Obama learned about 4 years ago, healthcare reform would not be the issue that would have wide bipartisan support. But there was an issue in healthcare that when you looked at the right and the left, both of them said, huh, this is weird that healthcare hasn't computerized. And why is that? And maybe if the federal government got behind it, we would be able to digitize healthcare and it would make things better. That was a logical way to think. And so at the State of the Union address, the president said, by computerizing health records, we can avoid mistakes, reduce costs, and improve care. Reasonable idea. He put the weight of the federal government behind the idea of digitizing healthcare. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. Just the fact that he had to make that speech is pretty remarkable. Can you imagine the president getting up and saying, we're going to put the federal government behind digitizing the travel industry or manufacturing or any other auto industry, any other industry you can think of? It would be ridiculous because those industries went digital on their own, because if they didn't, the companies would be dead. It was clear that there was a profound business case to go digital, and they all did, and if they didn't do it or didn't do it well, they went out of business. Medicine, for a lot of reasons, the sort of screwy incentives in medicine, the complexity, the regulatory environment, for a lot of reasons, medicine was not going digital organically and naturally. The president and his advisors perceived that and came to believe that if the federal government put their muscle behind it, that they would help us go digital more quickly. And so that's what he did. He started an office. It's called the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. shortened. That was Onchit. That was with a C. Later shortened again for obvious reasons to ONC. And the first director of the Office of the National Coordinator was this gentleman. Some of you may know him. His name is David Browder. He lives in town. He is an MD and a PhD in economics. He's a brilliant guy. I'm very fond of him because he introduced me to my wife. But that's not why he was selected to run the office. He was selected because he's a very smart physician, economist, who thought deeply about computerization. Congress gave David Browder an allocation to try to computerize the healthcare system, and it was $42 million. Now, think about that for a second. The U.S. healthcare economy is a $3 trillion economy, and David was given $42 million to transform it from analog to digital. This would be like saying to someone, I want you to change the direction of a battleship, put your feet into the ocean, and start kicking really hard. It's inconceivable that you could make any significant impact with $42 million. And what David did with his $42 million was some cheerleading, some convening, some standard setting, but there was no way you were going to hit a tipping point for an industry that was resisting computerization. 4 years later, David's successor was this gentleman. His name is David Blumenthal. He's a Harvard Health Policy professor. And he took over the ONC, and his budget to computerize American healthcare was a little bit larger. Anybody know what it was? All right, it was $30 billion. That's with a B. Any of you math fans out there, that's a 71,000% increase. Now, how could that possibly happen in our current political environment to find $30 billion to computerize an industry? Well, it's actually an amazing story. The way it happened was, you may recall, the economy imploding in 2008, and Lehman went out of business, and Bear Stearns went out of business, and we were looking at a depression. And the Bush administration was on its way out, Obama administration on its way in. Congress passed a $700 billion stimulus package. And if you recall, the mantra of what we were going to use that money to do, we were going to spend it on shovel-ready projects. What they were thinking was roads, highways, bridges, train tracks. But David Blumenthal and a few of his other colleagues, Bob Kocher, who is local, Zeke Emanuel, who is at Penn, saw a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There was a pile of $700 billion sitting there being ready to go to be spent on shovel-ready projects. They saw this opportunity to dive into the money pile and grab some dollars to fund healthcare digitization. And that's what they did, and they came out of that pile with their fistful of $30 billion. And that was almost 5% of the package. Nobody knows this, but 5% of the shovel-ready stimulus package really went to computerizing healthcare. It was a brilliant stroke. It was serendipity. Had the economy not imploded, there's no way that money would have been allocated by anyone. I don't think they would have gotten $300 million, let alone $30 billion. But they did, and they set up legislation and a set of regulations that allowed them then to dole out the $30 billion over the next 5 years, and that's what happened. And it worked. And by working, the measure I have is, did they digitize the American healthcare system? The answer is they did. This is the uptick in the number of doctors that accepted money from the federal government. The amount of money involved was about $40,000 for a physician's office, and for a large hospital like UCSF, it might have been $5 million or $10 million. That may sound like a lot, but when we bought our computer system at UCSF, it was about $300 or $400 million. So it wasn't like it was lavish, but it was enough, and it wasn't going to last very long. It was enough to make doctors and hospitals that said, I know we're going to have to computerize at some point. Maybe now is the time. And that's really what it did. It allowed us to hit a tipping point. Until 2008, remarkably, 10% of doctors' offices and 10% of hospitals had electronic health records. So 90% of hospitals in the United States in 2008, 90% of doctors' offices, the records were being kept in pen and paper and three-ring binders. By a year or so ago, that number was up to 70%. So this is a watershed moment in medicine, and part of the reason I got so interested in this is this is really the transformational point where we as an industry, arguably the most important industry we have, 18% of the gross domestic product, in a very short period of time, went from analog to digital. That's not true for other industries that did it organically and naturally. Their adoption curve was over the course of 10 or 20 years. Medicine had happened very quickly and without a lot of thought about its implications because the money was available and was going to go away. So this is sort of what got me interested. Okay, medicine has gone from analog to digital in a short period of time. We've been waiting for this, excited about it. It's happened. This is Rich Barron. Rich is a physician in Philadelphia now, is running the American Board of Internal Medicine, but was a primary care doc in a four-person practice in Philly for about 30 years, and a very smart, kind of ahead-of-the-curve kind of guy. And when Rich turned 50, which is in 2004, he told me that he had a midlife crisis, and he wanted to do something big and kind of, you know, kind of vigorous and interesting and different. And he said it was either an affair, the red sports car, or computerizing his office. He decided computerizing his office was the safest choice. He may have been wrong about that. So what he did is bought the best primary care office computer system in 2004, turned it on fittingly on Bastille Day in 2004. And he said to me, the staff came to work one day and nobody knew how to do their job. It's a really profound comment. And what it says, and turned out to be one of the themes of my research, is computerization profoundly alters the work in ways that are unpredictable and are not simply you taking out your iPhone and downloading an app, but really transform the nature of the work. It was, you know, Rich is a smart guy, and the vendor said, you should really think through everything you do before you put in the computer. So they tried, they really tried, but you can't do it. They could not, they turned on the computer and they said, oh my God, those post-it notes that we used to use, what do we do with those? Those phone calls, the messages, what do we do with that? And this issue of sort of trying to envision how your work is going to change in a technological era is extraordinarily tough for people. Henry Ford is reputed to have said, if I'd asked people what they really wanted, they would have said faster horses. People don't have the ability, we're not smart enough to really think about what it's going to look like in this new world, and in fact, we didn't. So that was part of what I came to see is this sort of change in workflow and communication patterns. Here was another example that told me that something was deeply wrong with the computerization of American healthcare. I had an op-ed in the Times a couple weeks ago where I wrote about this, so you may recall that. In 2014, an Arizona hospital just outside of Phoenix was advertising for a new emergency medicine physician. And here's the ad. Arizona General will be coming to the Grand Canyon State later this year. It's located in a suburb of Phoenix. It's a 40,000-square-foot boutique general hospital. Now, who would not want to work in a boutique general hospital? I mean, that sounds pretty damn good. Here was the ad. The ad said, we have an emergency room, which is a great idea if you're going to be hiring an ER doctor. You really want to have an emergency room. They had a radiology department with all the latest toys. They had two state-of-the-art operating rooms. They had outpatient surgery. They had 16 inpatient rooms, pretty small hospital. But the one, what was clearly their biggest selling point, it was the only part of the ad that was in bold, was they had no electronic medical record. So in 2014, a hospital was advertising for doctors by telling them, you can use pen and paper here. You don't have to use one of those newfangled computers. Just think about what that means in terms of the level of dissatisfaction. I'm imagining some of you might be physicians who are feeling some of this. We're all feeling some of this ourselves, in some ways because of the data entry burden, in some ways because of the sort of remarkable user unfriendliness of the current systems. So I'm going to talk to you briefly about, I'm going to talk about the digital transformation of radiology. You may wonder why, but I'll try to make clear why in a second. I'm going to talk about the eye patient. I'm going to talk about new kinds of errors, and I'm going to focus particularly on alert fatigue. I'm going to talk briefly about technical versus adaptive change, so I'm going to read a brief section for you in, of the book. Let's start with digital radiology. So first of all, let me just see, how many of you are doctors? Raise your hand if you're sort of smattering. How about nurses? All right, a few. Okay. So you, this will resonate for you. I think for the rest of you, let me explain why this is important. When I was a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, the central hub of the hospital was not in the CEO's mahogany-lined suite. It was not in the fanciest operating room of the big transplant or cardiac surgeon. It was here in the chest reading room where the chest x-rays were displayed. And that's what it looked like behind this gentleman. They were x-rays. They were hung on a gizmo called an alternator. To know what an alternator is, just think about your dry cleaner and that thing, but turn it on its side and put x-rays on it. It swivels around and pulls x-rays up. This gentleman's name was Wally Miller. Wally Miller was the a remarkable teacher and a chest radiologist at Penn. And the reason I say it was the center of the hospital was every day all of the teams, the medical teams, the surgical teams, came through the chest reading room to discuss their x-rays with Wally Miller. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. He'd come in and he'd say, "What team are you?" And you'd say, "Team B." And he'd say, "Okay." And he had to put his foot on this pedal and the thing would spin around, come to your films. And he'd say, "All right, what's going on?" And I was a medical student, so I was kind of quaking. And I'd say, "Well, it's a 42-year-old woman with shortness of breath and a cough." And he'd say, "What do you think's going on?" He'd show the x-ray and I'd say, "Pneumonia." And he'd say, "Nah." And, you know, I'd start shaking and he'd say, "No, look at that. It looks like tuberculosis." This interchange, this exchange was incredibly interesting. It was helpful for us as the team taking care of the patients. I can tell you, you can look at reports of x-rays all day long and you don't get the nuance that you get in talking to your colleague in radiology. It's also very important for the radiologists because they were connected to the doctors taking care of the patients in ways that otherwise wouldn't have happened. This is a guy named Paul Chang. He's a radiologist and informatics expert at the University of Chicago. Paul Chang was one of the world's leaders in the transformation of radiology from a film era to a digital era. And this happened about 15 years ago. It didn't require federal incentives, State of the Union addresses. It happened because when we got films, we no longer were getting chest x-rays that spat out two pieces of film. We were now getting CAT scans and MRIs, and they would spit out 100 pieces of film. Making a film version of each image costs about $4 a pop. And so it became impossibly expensive. Just storing them, you'd have to paper this room with one patient's x-rays. The cost of digital storage plummeted. Those two curves crossed. And really, within a couple of years, radiology went from analog to digital. The alternators, those belts went away. The films went away. It's all now on the computer. Paul Chang was one of the pioneers of this movement to digitize radiology. Paul Chang's father is a radiologist. And if you would think if your kid goes into your field and transforms the field, major advance to going digital, you would think his father would be incredibly impressed by what his son did. Paul Chang's father's nickname for his famous son is the man who ruined radiology. And the reason for that is, remember how magical these rounds were. We used to go down there and schmooze with the radiologists and this incredible give and take, and we learned something. The minute that radiology went digital, those rounds ended. Why did they end? Because we no longer had to go to radiology to look at the films. There weren't films anymore. We don't even call them films. We call them images. We never thought about that. And I'll tell you, when radiology went digital, I remember this, and I've since gone back and looked at all of the literature to see if I could find anybody expecting that this would happen. Anybody who even thought for a moment that when the film became the image and you could see it anywhere, radiology rounds would end. I can't find one person anywhere who even speculated that might happen. And yet, 10 minutes after it went digital, it happened. It was obvious. And so why do I tell you that story? Because I think it makes a broader point. Here's the broader point. That the digitization of the thing, in this case the film, creates the opportunity for, as they say in Silicon Valley, infinite scalability. I've learned in San Francisco that if you walk around the Mission District and you just say the word scalability a lot, a venture capitalist will come up and give you a check for $500,000. But that's the idea that's the Holy Grail, that is not one copy, there's ubiquitous copies, and that's what happens when you go digital, which is part of the idea. But here's the stuff that we tend not to anticipate. Social relationships and communication patterns that depended on gathering around the thing, in this case the film, will wither in ways that were unpredictable and yet obvious in retrospect. Power relationships mediated by who controls the thing will be renegotiated. What does that look like in radiology? Well, in the old days, if you wanted to look at your film, you had to go to Radiology World, and they controlled that ecosystem. Well, today you don't, and we begin to ask questions that we couldn't have asked before, like the neurologists are pretty good at reading head CAT scans. Do we really need a radiologist to do the same thing, read it again, and send a bill off? I'm not sure. Then you ask another set of questions, impossible in the film era. The average U.S. radiologist makes a little shy of $400,000 a year. The average radiologist in India makes an average of $40,000 a year. Are they really 10 times better? That's an irrelevant question when you're talking about film. It's a totally relevant question once the image is digital. So this is part of what happens when you've switched from analog to digital, things that we didn't expect. Now, radiology is interesting in a way, but it's small potatoes compared to what's really going on today and what the federal money created, which is now we're not talking about digitizing the film anymore. We're talking about digitizing all of the medical record. providing patients access to it in ways that they couldn't before. All sorts of wonderful things can happen, but also some problems. Let me talk about one of the problems. This, I see one of my colleagues here will know this room very well. This is the room on the 9th floor of UCSF Medical Center Parnassus that's filled with computers, packed all day and all night with doctors, residents, students doing their work on the computers. And that's terrific. They have to spend a lot of time doing their work on the computers. That's where the information is. Here is the medical service. This is where the patients are. It did not take me very long to set up this picture with no people in it. Why? Because all of the people are here. All of the people, until 4 or 5 years ago, were here. Why? Because that's where the chart was. So we would go and see our patients, and then we would settle down right outside the nurse's station to do our work, because there was only one version of the chart, and it lived on a rack in the nurse's station, and that's where we wrote our notes, wrote our orders, read our colleagues' notes. So it tethered us to the floor, and although our teamwork with nurses has never been fabulous, at least we were in the same physical space. But now we're not. The minute we're done seeing our patients, we flee the floor to our little tribal room where we hang out with each other. Did anybody predict that? I don't think they did. I never heard anybody talk about it. I never anticipated. And yet again, in 5 minutes after the record went digital, it was clear that it happened. So the issue of the record being digital changing communication patterns and geography in ways that I think in retrospect are totally predictable, but we did not anticipate, is a huge deal and something we have to be much more thoughtful about. Now, I've talked so far about relationships between doctors and nurses, doctors and doctors. Let's talk about doctors and patients. This is Abraham Verghese. Some of you know Abraham. He's at Stanford. He's an absolutely wonderful author. He wrote an article 7 years ago coining the term the eye patient. And he wrote this. It's a beautiful piece of writing. The patient is still at the center, but more as an icon for another entity clothed in binary garments, the eye patient. Often ER personnel have scanned, tested, and diagnosed so that interns or doctors meet a fully formed eye patient long before they meet the real patient. The eye patient's blood counts and emanations are tracked and trended like a Dow Jones index. And pop-up flags remind caregivers to feed or bleed. The eye patients are card-flipped in the bunker, while the real patients keep the beds warm and ensure that the folders bearing their names stay alive on the computer. In other words, we're taking care of the digital version of the patient more than we're taking care of the human version of the patient. Now, Abraham's a wonderful writer, but they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, so let me show you a picture. A 7-year-old girl went to see her pediatrician a few years ago and drew this really charming crayon drawing of her recollection of the visit to the doctor. These are the kinds of pictures that doctors often put up on a corkboard outside their office. This one I don't think went up on the corkboard. There she is, mother, sister, and there is the doctor. That is what she recalls of her visit to the pediatrician. How can she or her mother have any sense other than this doctor cares more about the computer than cares about me? So this is a huge problem. And how are we fixing it? Well, eventually the technology will get better and we'll be able to talk to people and voice recognition will pick it up. Today, the main fix for this is something called scribes. My wife wrote about this in the Times. It's the fastest growing profession in medicine. Young people, pre-medical students often, being hired to feed the computer so the doctor and the patient can look each other in the eye again. If you think about that, it's absolutely flabbergasting. Every other industry known to man computerizes, and as soon as they do, they start laying people off. Only in medicine could we figure out a way of computerizing and bringing in extra bodies. It's really our special talent as an employment engine. I promised that I would tell you about a case that happened at UCSF, and I do this with the permission of the institution, which takes, I think, considerable courage. I'm not going to go through it in great detail. It's written about in great detail in the book, and we published an excerpt of this on a website called Medium a couple of weeks ago that's gotten almost 500,000 hits, so it's now become reasonably well known. And I'm proud of UCSF for allowing me to talk about it because I think it's quite important. A 16-year-old boy who weighs 38.6 kilograms, that's about 80 pounds, who has a chronic genetic immunodeficiency, was admitted for a colonoscopy as part of a workup he was having some gastrointestinal bleeding. He was on multiple home medicines, including an antibiotic known as trimethoprim sulfa. The brand name is Septra. Double strength, that's the DS, 160 milligrams, and that's the size of the trimethoprim, twice daily for prophylaxis, meaning prevention of lung infections or skin infections, which he had problems with. He'd been on that medicine for several years at the time of his admission. Medical Center had recently installed a state-of-the-art electronic health record, computerized order entry system. This is a system built by a company called Epic. This is the best system that a lot of money can buy. If you look at the hospitals that U.S. News calls the America's top 10 hospitals, sort of a silly list, but as long as UCSF is on it, we put it on every billboard in San Francisco, and we usually are. 9 of those 10 hospitals use this particular system. So this is the best system that's out there. So, yeah. It is the best. It's been rated as the best system that's out there. I think it probably is the best system that's out there for a big, complicated hospital. We can talk about that later, because I understand where that's coming from. And I have absolutely no interest in Epic. In fact, they've pissed me off lately, and I'll tell you why in a second. At 1:09 in the afternoon, the admissions orders were written for this teenager, including an order to give him 38 and a half pills. Just want to emphasize that. Remember, he was supposed to be getting one pill twice a day. We wrote an order to give him 38 and a half of them. 9 hours later, a nurse gave him 38 and a half tablets, and he took all of them. 14 hours later, he had a grand mal seizure and briefly stopped breathing. A code blue was called. A week later, he left the intensive care unit. About 10 days later, he left the hospital. And thankfully, he is doing well today, and I suspect will never, ever have a urinary tract infection for the rest of his life. So, legitimate for you to ask how this could happen, legitimate for you to wonder about how careless the people were, or stupid they were, or how bad the computer system was. And I've looked at a lot of the computer systems, and none of them are great by any means. And I'm going to talk about some of the flaws in this one, but all of them share many of the same problems. And I can tell you, working at UCSF for many, many years, it's not like we don't have some bad doctors or nurses, but most of the people that we have are really quite spectacularly good, smart, careful, want to do the right thing. And I interviewed the nurse, the doctor, and the pharmacist involved in this area, all good, competent people, feel quite terrible about this. And the reason it happened, I think, has less to do with bad people and more to do with the system. So here was the dose that the doctor intended to write, one of these pills twice a day. This kid had been on it for, as I said, several years. This is the dose that the doctor ended up writing for, 38 and a half of these pills. This is what it looks like when they are shrink-wrapped and barcoded. And I don't have time to go through it in detail, but let me sort of give you the high level, the highlights of what the issues were. The first issue is we created a process where the doctor had to order the medication in what are called milligrams per kilogram, meaning based on the weight of the child. Meaning that even though she knew the correct dose, which was one pill, she wasn't allowed to do that by the system. She ordered it in milligrams per kilogram. Turned out there was a slight problem with the dose. The pharmacist called the doctor and said, you need to reorder it. The right dose is 160 in milligrams. She did that, not noticing that the screen was still set for milligrams per kilogram. All right, so it's a little complicated. It'd be the equivalent of going from English to Spanish and then translating back into English again, and you don't get the same thing that you started with. Multiple sort of back and forths. Profound lack of user-centered design, and I'll talk about that in a second when we talk about alerts. Automation replacing human check. So at the end of this chain, the nurse finally sees this order for 39 pills. It's in her computer. And she says, this is really weird, 39 pills, but she happened to be on an unfamiliar floor. She was floating on a different floor that she normally worked. And she says, I'm going to check it with my barcode machine. And she barcodes pill number one, and the barcode machine says, that's not right. I need to see 38 more. Because at that stage of the medication process, the job of the barcode machine is to make sure the nurse gives the medication that is written. In addition, one other piece of automation. In the old days, if the doctor wrote an order for 39 pills, however that could happen, at some point in the process it would have gone to a pharmacy technician who would have spat out a label printer, said 39 pills. The pharmacy tech would have picked up a bottle, started pouring it out, and then would have said, what the hell? But now it goes to a robot that says 39 pills, no problem, I can do that. That's part of what happened. Everybody feeling time pressure to move along, the computer sort of makes that even worse. In the absence of what's called a stop-the-line culture, that's a saying from Toyota production system, of people being empowered to say, this is weird, I'm going to stop everything and double or triple check it. That did not happen in this case. What I want to focus on for a minute is alert fatigue. So when the doctor wrote an order for 39 pills, the computer system, of course, fires an alert. But the alert for 39 pills looks exactly the same as the alert for a 1% overdose. It looks exactly the same as you shouldn't give this medicine with grapefruit juice. And the doctors get, at UCSF in a month, get 30,000 alerts. The pharmacists get 150,000 alerts. And that's not all the alerts that we get. Here is another kind of alert that doctors and nurses get all the time. This is the intensive care unit monitor. This monitors your heart rate and your blood pressure and your oxygen level and the EKG tracing. Barbara Drew, a nurse researcher at UCSF, did a study recently. In 1 month, in 70 ICU beds at UCSF, take a guess how many alerts this machine fired. 70 ICU beds. Mark, what would you guess? 70 ICU beds, how many alerts do you think that thing fires in a month? Oh, you read my book. So somebody didn't read the book. Anybody take a guess? Yeah. A million alerts. Wow. 70,000. You underestimate it. It's 2.5 million alerts in a month. In the intensive care unit, this thing fires off 2.5 million alerts in a month. There's one audible alert every 7 minutes. Barbara asked a nurse when the alerts were going off like grenades on the beach in Normandy, you know, and everybody was jumping. She said, what would make you worry that a patient was really sick? And the nurse said, if the alerts stopped, if there was silence, I would be worried that something was wrong. As I mentioned, I spent a day at Boeing to see how they think about alerts and computerization. And I told them this. I told them the frequency of alerts. They were flabbergasted. They said, we can alert the pilot on everything, but we put in the alerts, and then we watch and see what happens. And when they're firing all the time and people are ignoring them, we know we have to pull them out because we know it's profoundly unsafe. I also told them that the alert for a 39-fold overdose looks the same as a 1% overdose. Again, they were flabbergasted. The alerts for the plane is about to fall out of the sky are red, and there's the voice, and there's the steering wheel start shaking. And they said, and if it's a lower level alert, like the pilot needs to know, but not this second, it might be amber, and there's no voice, and there's no stick shaker. They're totally graded. I said, give me an example of a lower level alert. You know, the pilots need to know, but they don't need to do anything this second. And the chief engineer for Boeing said, he thought about it for a second, he said, one of the engines is on fire. And I said, that's a lower level alert? He said, yeah, you know, we don't think the pilots need to know about it this second, but we think they should know. And I said, oh, that's terrific. I feel much better about that. So this is just one of many problems. What's a 39-fold overdose like? This would be like driving down 101 and seeing a sign that said the speed limit is 2,500 miles per hour. It is clearly a ridiculous dose. The nurse, in retrospect, realizes it's a ridiculous dose. But the signals that she was getting, the alerts were being ignored. By the time it gets to her, she says a doctor approved it, a pharmacist approved it. The barcode confirms it's the right dose. It must be right. The four most dangerous words in medicine, it must be right. To show you what 39 pills look like, I didn't do this at work. Luckily, I did this at home. That's the wine glass. And I couldn't find 39 Ceptras, so these are my Centrum Silvers, but they're about the same size. That's what it looks like. That's what she fed to a kid. Let me finish up and say, what do we need to do? Unfortunately, this is one of those complicated problems where it's not like there's one thing. There's a bunch of stuff. Clearly, the vendors have to engage in much more user-centered design. They have to watch and see what happens when doctors and nurses use their systems. They do this woefully little. One of the things that so impressed me about Boeing was not only do they do it because they know it will create a better and safer airplane, but they said to me things like, we couldn't imagine not doing it. That would be disrespectful of the pilots. It would be not having the reverence for the pilots who have died to teach us these lessons. So that's one issue. A second issue is it's not all the vendors' issue. We have to get better at using computers in new ways. Those of you who are doctors or nurses know that the notes have become bloated and useless. That's ours to teach people how to write a good note in the digital era. I think the computers can help, but it's largely our work to fix it. Alert fatigue, I've already talked about. We have to talk about these cases. Too often we don't talk about these cases. Part of the reason is I didn't show you any screenshots from Epic, but I have in other talks, and I have in my book and in articles. I needed the company's permission to do that. To me, that's unethical. To me, the idea that the company can say you can't disseminate a screenshot that shows you an error-prone condition which could prevent another patient being harmed, that's unethical. That they should be able to do that is written into their contracts, and that's going to be my next major crusade to try to take that on. At the federal level, the federal government, I think, did the right thing by throwing the $30 billion at us. I think we needed to cross a tipping point. I think they succeeded in doing it. The problem is it created a level of federal oversight and regulatory engagement in sort of what the computers do that I think is now unhealthy. Those insiders will know this is something called meaningful use, a very vigorous, in-the-weeds set of federal regulations that I don't think can work in technology. It just moves too quickly. And I think basically the federal government said, we're putting $30 billion in, we're all in, and we got to make sure we get our money's worth. That was reasonable early on. But the example here really is the example of the Internet, where the federal government was very involved in the early days of the Internet. The federal government really was the research at DARPA that created the Internet. But as soon as it was a thing, they were wise enough to pull back and let the Internet be managed largely privately and by not-for-profits. I think that's the right model here. I came to believe that part of the issue here is what's known as technical versus adaptive change. This is Ron Heifetz, who's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Technical change is your iPhone. You sort of take out an app, and you don't even have to read the instructions. It's self-evident. You do it, and it's fine, and everything works. And I think we mistakenly believe that wiring healthcare was technical change. It is the mother of all adaptive changes. Adaptive change, as Heifetz writes, problems that require people themselves to change. And adaptive problems, the people are the problem, the people are the solution, and leadership is about mobilizing and engaging the people with the problem rather than trying to anesthetize them so that you can solve it, go off and solve it on your own. We were naive about that. We didn't think that that was the nature of the problem, but it's quite clear to me, at least, that it is. I'm going to end with a reading. This is actually the end of the book, and I do this because I actually want to. We've been talking about policy and errors and technology and gizmos, and I want to bring this back to the patient. So, and I think you'll see why in a second. A couple of years ago, I was caring for a patient in his 70s, let's call him Mr. Gordon, in the ICU at UCSF Medical Center. This was a challenging case. While it was clinically obvious that the patient who had widely metastatic cancer was going to die, several members of his family had not come to terms with this sad reality. Layered on top of that, I sensed significant conflict within the family. The patient's son and daughter were cool toward each other, nearly businesslike, and the son and the daughter's husband could hardly stand to be in the same room. As Mr. Gordon drifted in and out of consciousness, I sat down with the family in a conference room just outside the ICU. The family tension suffused the room with a heavy air, the smog of long-standing resentments. I described the clinical situation. I told them how it was that we were sure that Mr. Gordon was dying. I gave them my assessment that ongoing aggressive care would be futile and inhumane. I recounted my consultation with the ICU specialist, the oncologist, and the palliative care team, all of whom endorsed my prognosis. I told them that I understood their desire to keep Mr. Gordon alive, but that I believed that the time had come to stop trying. After talking for a while, the family members began to describe some happy memories of their time with Mr. Gordon and recalled his attitudes about end-of-life care. It became clear he would not have wanted aggressive care at this stage. I could feel them gradually casting aside their grievances, if only temporarily, as they coalesced around his interests. Their questions answered, I left the room and returned to the ICU. A few minutes later, Mr. Gordon's son, holding back tears, found me in the ICU and told me the family had decided that it was time to allow his dad to die peacefully. I replied that I understood how wrenching this decision was, but that it was the right one that I would make for one of my own parents. He went back to the waiting room to rejoin his family. I entered Mr. Gordon's room and informed the nurse that we would be switching from our current full-court press to comfort care. I asked the nurse to turn down the oxygen on the ventilator, to remove all the IVs except the one for morphine, and to bring some chairs in the room to allow the family to be at the patient's bedside during his final minutes. I walked out to the waiting room to inform the family that the time had come, and then escorted them in to see Mr. Gordon for the last time. They entered the room one by one. The two siblings embraced. The son and son-in-law nodded at each other, an act I interpreted as a momentary truce, and all four took seats surrounding the patient's bed. Mr. Gordon lay still, now unconscious from his morphine drip. The stage was set, but then I noticed a problem. In his haste to discontinue the various tubes and treatments, the nurse had forgotten to disconnect the bedside cardiac monitor, which continued to flicker a few feet above Mr. Gordon's head. And so it was that at one of life's most profound moments, a moment nearly impossible in its mystery and poignancy, a moment paradoxically rich with promise and ineffable sadness, all four family members' eyes were raised, not searching for truth or for God, but watching little squiggles, each the electronic signature of a heartbeat, march across a rectangular screen. Mr. Gordon's son was sitting closest to the monitor. I put my hand on his shoulder. Speaking to all of them, I said, "Your dad is comfortable, and I'm so glad you could all be here with him. I'm sure he is too. But," and I pointed to the heart monitor, "there is absolutely nothing on this screen that matters." And I pressed the off button. As the screen went to black, the family member shared a look of shock, then clarity, and then, what was it? Acceptance, warmth, gratitude, transcendence, maybe even love. After a moment of gathering themselves, each turned to Mr. Gordon, squeezed his hands, stroked his arm, touched his cheek. The scene was pure, peaceful, and in a way that is hard to describe, quite beautiful. And then he died. Thank you so much for your attention. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bob, for that wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
A number of you have submitted questions. Please feel free to continue to do so. We have some time. I'm going to start with the first one, because, Bob, you'll be interested to know that while you've been busy writing your book, in my office south of Market here, my staff has created the answer to all the technical problems you've mentioned.
Fabulous.
And plenty more. So tomorrow we're going to launch it, and is there any reason that it won't be two questions. Any reason it won't be completely and immediately embraced by doctors, patients, hospitals, and do them a lot of good? My team will make a lot of money. Won't that be great? Question number two, given that we solved all the technical problems, any reason people should still buy your book?
And you're not going to tell us what this thing is?
No, it doesn't matter. It solves all the technical problems. Is that all the problems we have?
No. So, you know, I came to believe that the technical piece of this is actually a relatively small part of the problem. And it's actually quite a typical problem. One of the things that was fun for me to do is research the history of digitization of other industries. And there's something in other industries that's known as the productivity paradox. And the productivity paradox basically says that we're going to put computers into whatever industry, manufacturing or travel, and it's going to make things better and safer and cheaper, and it's all great. And it never works for about 10 or 15 years. And the history is that 10 or 15 years, it's not so much the technology gets better, it's that people reimagine the work. People think about the work in brand new ways. And that, I think, is the issue here. I think the technology needs to get better, but the policy environment, how do we get these machines to connect to each other? That's actually not a technological problem. That's a business case problem. We don't go to radiology rounds anymore. We can't just sit here and lament that and say, let's go down there anymore. Maybe that's not right, but we need to ask, how do we communicate with the radiologists in new ways? That may require new complementary technologies that we need to develop. Patients now have access to their medical records. That's terrific, but they're trying to read gobbledygook in Latin. Maybe we need new kinds of interfaces that they see the information in new and user-friendly ways. So one of the things that actually is most exciting, maybe this is what your company is developing, which would be terrific, and you will get rich, is that this $30 billion did two things. And one is it created a market for the traditional healthcare information technology systems, one of which is Epic, which are based on pretty old technology, servers in your basement. This is sort of Microsoft Word 1.0 kind of stuff. But the second thing it did is it got Silicon Valley interested in healthcare, which Silicon Valley had traditionally not been interested in healthcare, even though it was 18% of the GDP, because they said, this is a mess, we're going to leave it alone. Companies like Google, I was on Google's advisory board 8 years ago when it tried to do healthcare. They left with their tail between their legs saying, no, we want no part of this. They're all jumping back in now, and you see Apple doing it, and you see Google doing it, you see startups doing it. So that's what's exciting, that when you have now the doctor's office, the hospital now beginning to connect to new apps, and then it really gets pretty impressive pretty quickly. You may have seen yesterday or 2 days ago, IBM announced a brand new initiative of taking Watson and melding together all this information and analyzing it. It won't make things better tomorrow, but it's going to make things better, 5 years. 7 years, maybe not five.
So the technology enables but doesn't solve all the problems.
That's
a lot
correct.
Of human problems. A lot of the human problems, and some that you talked about a bit, have to do with sort of how well the computer links to the user and how user-centered it is. We had a couple of questions from the audience about that. I'll try to combine them. One is, to what degree is the problem that end users have been too busy to help with the design, which often happens in many industries? And the second is, looking at Epic specifically or some of the other, I know you talked about Athena in your book and so forth, to what degree have you talked to these organizations about better user-centered designs and how they responded?
That part of the problem is, you ask a busy doctor to come in and help us design technology, and it's like, I'm busy, I'm not going to do that. But, Epic's a $3 billion company. If they threw some money at this problem, they could get doctors and nurses in there to help them build their systems better. Part of the problem is, to be fair to them and the other vendors, is Boeing has a far easier problem. First of all, the complexity of the system is orders of magnitude less. Second of all, they build the whole thing. They're building the ecosystem. So they can say, we're not letting this 777 out to nature until it's completely baked and all the pieces fit together. Epic and Cerner and Athena, they don't run hospitals, they don't run doctor's offices. So they have to go out of their way to see what it's like to use their systems. But that's not an excuse. They need to, and they haven't, and they need to be pushed to do that. When you bring it up with the vendors, they say, yeah, we think it's important. We're doing a little bit, but they're doing it in a pretty half-hearted way, because I actually don't think their heart's in it. I think that, they're smart people. They're not trying to do bad stuff. But if you've got a lot of really smart engineers who think they know computer design and they think they sort of vaguely know healthcare, they think they can do it. And I don't think they have any idea of even if their system is working in a microcosm, the connection between their system and that system and the workflow, I don't think they have any idea how difficult this is until they get out into the field and watch it. And the question will be whether these companies, Epic is the example everybody uses because they've really won the game. They are clearly the winner in the market. They've done very well not doing that by building a system that's pretty good and solves a whole lot of problems. And the question is whether sort of the kind of new, nimble companies that think cloud and think about modern technological designs, whether any of them can come in and displace these companies. It's pretty tricky to do, because building a hospital computer system is not something you can do in your garage.
Well, and you brought up in the book the example of contrasting Epic with Athena, which takes a very different approach and a cloud-based approach and a new, young, hip, sort of a Bay Area kind of approach, even though it's a Boston-based company.
Yeah, it's Bay Area-ish.
Area-ish. and yet you also point out that it doesn't have anything close to the number of modules it needs to
right.
So, to
so
serve
Athena,
hospital.
Athena began, Athena's an interesting story. Its founding CEO is a piece of work. He's a guy named Jonathan Bush, who is kind of the most quotable and a little bit of a lunatic but brilliant guy, and also is the cousin and nephew of a president, of two different presidents, and more importantly, the brother of the host, I think, of Entertainment Tonight or something, one of those shows on TV. And he, he's out there chest thumping saying, we have a system that can whoop Epic. What his system can do and do better than Epic is a small office, because it is cloud-based. They can sit outside Boston and see where all the clicks are and adjust it tomorrow if it's not working well, something a company like Epic or Cerner can't do. But the problem is, he can only right now serve a small office. If UCSF said, wow, we just heard Jonathan Bush, it's cool, we want to buy Athena, he can't come close to serving the needs of a large, complex hospital.
Mm-hmm. And I guess when you look at apps, which we're all very familiar with in this part of the world, they can really perhaps help with some personal health, but they can't solve the problems we're talking about.
I get asked this all the time, because it's very sexy to be thinking about apps and sensors and wellness and all that kind of stuff. And there are a couple of problems with it. First of all, I have a jawbone on now. I had a Fitbit before. I haven't looked at it for 3 months. I don't know why I still wear it, it's just on my belt. You know, you use it for a little while, and then you get bored with it, and that is useful data. Actually, I think knowing my steps actually is useful. What possible use a patient could have to know their heart rate minute to minute? I mean, I take care of patients in the ICU who are this far away from dying, and I don't need to know their heart rate minute to minute. Why a perfectly well 32-year-old would need to know that? So these things are being hyped in a way that I don't think, you know, a lot of them are throwing off data that's not useful. But the second issue is, you know, I know you had Eric Topol here before. Eric talks about how all this data, you know, of your heart rate, your blood pressure, your sweat, your this, that, will go to your primary care doctor who will be thrilled to see this data on 2,000 patients. I don't know a primary care doctor who wouldn't kill themselves if they were getting data like that on 2,000 patients. So we just haven't begun to figure it out. Eventually, this will all weave together and be useful, but now there's a lot of froth.
This week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, which I just saw today for the first time, has an editorial by David Blumenthal, whom you mentioned in your talk.
Yep.
About an article in the same issue that really talked about breaches in healthcare data.
Yeah.
And the real question that arises, because two-thirds of those breaches were electronic.
Yeah.
So a question that arises is, the more we computerize medical records, don't we have greater and greater opportunity for those kind of data breaches? And to the degree that we have any of those breaches, we're seeing them all the time in the consumer stores and so forth, will that make patients less willing to participate in this whole environment?
Yeah, I think we have this conundrum where what we want as a system is for the data to be as liquid as possible, and we don't just want it. The typical use case for that is, you know, I'm driving through Fresno and I get in a car accident, I go to the ER, and wouldn't it be wonderful if they could see my record? And that's yes, and that would be nice. But the real utility of having everybody's data liquid is the ability to analyze, you know, a million patients who have leukemia and try to figure out what the best treatment is. Those sort of things, and build apps that sort of connect people in ways that are wonderful. But we haven't figured out how to make the data liquid and ubiquitous without also making it liquid and ubiquitous for a North Korean hacker. Mm-hmm. And people have been sort of bad-mouthing healthcare that we're not approaching security in a serious and the right way because, you know, Anthem just had 80 million records hacked, but so did J.P. Morgan. You know, it's not like anybody has figured this out yet. You're absolutely right. If we don't figure it out, that will markedly limit people's willingness to share their data because, you know, losing your financial records is one thing, but losing information about your psychiatric history or your HIV status is a very big deal. I don't think anybody has the answer yet. It's clear that we've got to approach this in a much more serious way than we have so far.
You, on a couple occasions during your presentation, talked about how relationships can actually be inhibited by technology. You talked about relationships between doctors and between doctor and patient, like the girl's cartoon.
Yeah.
Is that inevitable? Or do you believe that the more we computerize, the worse the relationships will get, or the more difficult?
I think one's attitude about that is probably colored by your attitude about your kids, and whether you think your kids have better or worse relationships since they're on Facebook and they tweet and they send texts or whatever they do today. I've lost track. And you could argue it both ways. You know, you could argue that they don't have the sort of deep interpersonal, you know, human relationships that we had. And on the other hand, you know, my kids are friends with people in Europe and communicating with people they don't see geographically. So I think it can cut both ways. It's a double-edged sword. And I could easily see ways that the technology will enhance relationships. And one clear example is if you're at Kaiser Permanente, you're probably emailing your doctor all the time now. That's fabulous. I mean, how could that, as long as we figure out for the doctor, how does that sort of, how's your workflow manage that? Because in the beginning, we just say you're going to keep seeing all the patients in your office, and also you're going to do 2 hours of email with your patients. That doesn't compute. But once we figure it out, it's got to be a good thing net if patients can connect with their doctors or some other providers in an electronic way, or be seen through telemedicine, or the doctor can, or whoever is helping to manage them, can help guide them in sort of certain behaviors through things that happen naturally in their home and in their workplace. I think that's good, and I think then the question is, how do you mitigate the harms? How do you say, okay, that's terrific, but here are the things that we've lost. We spent a lot of energy at UCSF trying to enhance the doctor and nurse teamwork, and all of a sudden it's happening less because we're not in the same physical space. So then we have to say, do we just try to recreate? You have to be careful not to get too nostalgic and say, let's do what we used to do. That might not be the right answer. The right answer starts with saying, what have we lost? How do we get it back in some form? and how do we reimagine it in this new technological era? And it might look very different. It might be a technologically enabled form of communication rather than person to person. But we'll never get there unless we start asking those questions.
Mm-hmm. Great. We had a couple of questions about money. Flip sides of it. One was, this will cost a lot to program all this stuff. Are there still more government funds available? And so where can you get them?
Zero.
Okay, that's an easy one. I guess the flip side is from the consumer standpoint. Do you believe that digitization will reduce the cost of healthcare, I guess both in general, but also directly to consumers?
So the government money ran out about 6 months ago. So if you were waiting for it, you've waited too long. The government, in its wisdom now, still has that set of regulations saying you need to have a computer system that does X, Y, and Z, but now if you don't have it, they're going to start penalizing you. So it sort of goes from being kind of a fun, oh, I'm getting an extra paycheck from the government, to kind of nasty, nasty penalties. I can't see it happening again. I think the government correctly feels that they created a tipping point, and now everybody's got to go digital. Because there's a parallel trend, and Mark, you know this better than I do, which is at the same time we're digitizing healthcare, there's a set of additional pressures on doctors and hospitals to deliver high-quality, safe, satisfying care, pressures that did not exist before. But now it's more like another business, that if you're not showing that you're delivering high-quality, safe care, you're going to start getting dinged. And in that environment, you realize, I need a computer to do this. Mm-hmm. So I think the forces for computerization are really quite strong and no longer need federal money, and there will not be more federal money. Will it cut costs? This is the productivity paradox. A Nobel Prize winner in economics in 1988 said you can see the productivity advantages of computerization everywhere but in the statistics. Mm-hmm. Because you weren't seeing them. And everybody said, we're going to computerize, we're going to save money in the financial industry and the businesses. It didn't happen. And then it happened 10 years later, again, as they figured out the workflows. I think the same thing is true in healthcare. Part of the sale for the $30 billion to Congress was projections from the RAND Corporation that said computerizing the healthcare system will save $80 billion a year. Right. They redid that study last year. The savings have been zero. I don't think it makes the projections wrong. I think it makes the time course wrong. And why will it ultimately save money? Because ultimately you will be able to get care at home that right now you have to see a doctor. Right now, and you will be able to get care from a coach or a case manager who's making $100,000 a year instead of a doctor who's making $250,000. It enables people to do things themselves and allows less expensive providers to do things that previously needed very expensive providers to do. And all of that just takes time to kind of work out the people and the systems and how information flows. But you can, even at UCSF, the first year we put in Epic, which was 3 or 4 years ago, we weren't thinking about any of this stuff. You're just trying to get the machines to work and make sure you're sending off bills and make sure you haven't lost any patients. It's kind of blocking and tackling. And then you get to year two or three and you start getting comfortable and you start saying things like, when we have a patient who needs to see a cardiologist, do we really need to have them make an appointment, go see the cardiologist, take a week, come back to see me a week later, when all I want is the answer to a simple question? And so we came up with a system where we now email the cardiologist with the question. The cardiologist gets back to us the day later. The cardiologist can read the patient's record. I can see the patient the next day. I mean, so much better and more efficient for everybody. Doing that had nothing to do with the technology. The technology was trivially easy. It was, who's the cardiologist? Where do they sit? How does the information flow? How does it make it into the record? It's essentially the reimagining of the work. That's where the money savings occurs. And it takes a little while, but I think we'll get there.
Our thanks to Dr. Bob Wachter for his comments today. Would also like to thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Mm-hmm.